Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you'll hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Mesner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Emma, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's program. And today's program is being done in collaboration or in partnership, actually, with the Longevity Foundation. So today's program is, and you'll be hearing more about the Longevity Foundation as the program goes on. And today's program, Life with Small Cell Lung Cancer workshop series, has been funded in part by Jazz Pharmaceuticals, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. And we have over 213 participants on the call today, and you might primarily come to the United States from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. We do, however, have a number of participants from international countries: Canada, Egypt, Kenya, Malawi, Mauritius, Nigeria, Spain, and the United Kingdom. So it is a global call as well. And we're delighted that you've just chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Misty Dawn Shields. Dr. Shields is Assistant Professor of Clinical Medicine, Department of Medicine, Division of Hematology Oncology, Vienna University School of Medicine, Associate Member, Experimental and Developmental Therapeutics, Vienna University, Melvin and Bren Simon Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Shields will be addressing overview of small cell lung cancer in the context of COVID, Omicron, seasonal flu, and allergies, the role of chemotherapy and immunotherapy, preventing and managing treatment side effects, key questions to ask your healthcare team, and when to call your healthcare team about treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Shields.
Thank you, Dr. Mesner, for the wonderful introduction, and thank you to the Cancer Care Connect workshop and the Longevity Foundation for this teleconference today and the invitation to speak with 213 global participants. Thank you all for allowing me to take some of your time this afternoon or today, depending on where you are in the world. As mentioned, I am a assistant professor at Indiana University. I have a clinical and research focus in small cell lung cancer. For me, small cell lung cancer is very personal. I lost my father to small cell when I was 15 years old, impacting the path of my life to pursue being an oncologist and to help patients and their families who are afflicted by small cell lung cancer. So it's an honor to be here and an honor to serve. A few points about small cell lung cancer. So lung cancer is one of the most common forms of cancer that impacts the world today. Small cell lung cancer makes up about 14 to 15% of the population affected by lung cancer. Can be diagnosed into two major stages, limited stage and extensive stage disease. It's important to know that small cell lung cancer is treatable at any stage, and there are treatment options that are available for all patients, including supportive care measures as well. You know, the last several years have been quite unprecedented with COVID and the pandemic that we've all faced and has impacted all of our lives. And, you know, it has really seemed to change the way that we live our day to day. COVID has impacted the way that we treat cancer and specifically lung cancer. It's known that the pandemic unfortunately delayed a lot of patients from seeking care for their lung cancer, and that has made an impact. And so the threat of COVID and COVID infections, as well as other infections, including flu, and sometimes the great masquerader of seasonal allergies can impact your quality of life and symptoms related to your battle with small cell lung cancer or your loved one's treatments or therapeutic plans. And so it's really important as we navigate this unprecedented time for COVID, including Omicron, and unfortunately maybe any other emerging variant strain, is to really try to stay up to date with all the recommended guidelines here in America, the CDC, or the Center for Disease Control, including also speaking with your primary care physician and your medical team about what precautions you may be able to take to help limit your risk or to limit severe infections related to COVID or flu or any other viruses, including the common cold. And so it's important to take precautions if you know that a loved one or a friend is sick or ill and maybe questionable a respiratory virus. Stay away, limit your exposure to crowds, stay updated on the vaccines. You know, really pursuing great hand hygiene and hand washing, and continuing to speak with your primary care physician as well as your medical oncologist about what's right for you, where you are in your treatment, about what treatments are available for you and precautions you can take. I'm happy in the comment section and the question and answer section to answer any additional questions related to COVID, flu, Omicron, or seasonal allergies. Second of all, I would like to address the role of chemotherapy and immunotherapy for small cell lung cancer. What we know about the treatment of small cell lung cancer is that chemotherapy is typically the mainstay, which is kind of the backbone for how we treat small cell lung cancer. Chemotherapy includes drugs that can shrink the size or stabilize the size of your lung cancer and help to prevent or limit spread of the lung cancer. We know that chemotherapy can be given alone or with radiation, including radiation to the chest, as we see in patients with limited stage small cell, or it can be given in combination with immunotherapy in patients who are diagnosed with extensive stage small cell lung cancer. Immunotherapy is a type of treatment that can be given as an anti-cancer treatment that affects the PD-1 or PD-L1 pathways. These are important for our immune system to help increase our immune system to fight cancer. This is shown to prove improvements in patients living longer with small cell lung cancer and helping in aiding the fight against small cell lung cancer. So it's important to know with your medical oncologist whether that is a treatment that's right for you, because sometimes patients do not qualify for these treatments if they have known history of autoimmune disorders, things like lupus or Sjogren's, rheumatoid arthritis if it's severe and they need to take medications, or if it's severe and uncontrolled, or if you need to take certain medications like steroids or prednisone at high levels, because that can kind of block the effectiveness of the immunotherapy, kind of like having the gas on both the foot of the brake and on the gas at the same time of a car. And so what we know, the chemotherapy options are available for first-line therapy for small cell, meaning the first treatments you receive. There's also chemotherapy options for second-line, as well as third-line, as well as also for clinical trials that we'll talk about in a moment. It's important to know that for small cell lung cancer, that your treatment should be made up of a multidisciplinary team. These are made up of several different oncology-focused team members, including physicians and nurses or advanced practice providers, and they can discuss the right treatment options or treatment plans for you or your family member to help either reduce the symptoms or reduce the burden of disease that or you or your loved one might be facing. These are all shared decision making, and so that you have a voice at the table for your decisions, and you get to pick what you feel is right for you with an informed discussion. Along with treatments, unfortunately, all drugs do have side effects. There is no drug that does not have a single side effect, and so it's important to discuss as you're discussing chemotherapy such as etoposide or carboplatin or cisplatin or irinotecan or topotecan or lurbinectedin. These are all common chemotherapies given for small cell. What should I expect? What is the goal of therapy? How long should I be on therapy? What are the short-term side effects? What are the long-term side effects? If I have a side effect, who do I call? How do I know when to call? How soon? What should I try? Are there medications or support that I can try at home to limit going to the urgent care or emergency room? Or are there certain times whenever there are emergencies that need to go immediately to the urgent care or hospital to seek evaluation and treatment? Side effects from chemotherapy typically can range, and each person's response and side effect profile may be different. So it's important to speak with your team, including your medical oncologist or your radiation oncologist, about what this looks like and what should you expect. What we do know about chemotherapy and immunotherapy are that the drug side effect profiles can tend to be very different and variable. Chemotherapy may cause side effects that you're familiar with or have maybe heard or had a loved one experience, including fatigue, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, or hair loss or hair thinning. Whereas immunotherapy is side effects are related to using your immune system to ramp up and fight the cancer. And so those look kind of different than chemotherapy in terms of its inflammation of organs that we need to go throughout our normal day, including inflammation perhaps in the skin, dermatitis, which would be a rash, or inflammation in the liver, hepatitis, which may cause jaundice or itching. Rarely we can see inflammation in the lungs, pneumonitis. And this is typically something that is best when caught early, and so we need to know about these side effects if you have a fever, a new cough, diarrhea, rash, confusion. These are all necessary for your healthcare providers to know so that they can provide timely and prompt management, including potentially supportive medications, including fluids or anti-diarrhea medicines or steroids, including topical skin creams or pills or IV steroids. And so it's really important to know that the side effect profiles are unique and different to each regimen or combinations of regimens. And so you must ask your multidisciplinary team, what should I expect? When do I call? And how do I provide this feedback to the team so that I can help to stay on treatment and expedite this information so it's caught early? And caught early means it can be managed hopefully effectively with appropriate treatments. Furthermore, I want to, you know, obviously, again, highlight emergencies that may be related to therapies, including but not limited to things like fever. So here in the U.S., 100.4 or higher Fahrenheit would be considered a fever that you should notify your team and let them know if it's going on and whether what to do next. Things like confusion, or generally being unwell, severe nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea that may lead to dehydration, or seizures. These are all emergencies that your care team must know about. We will talk about one more item, including clinical trials that are available to patients with lung cancer, including small cell lung cancer. So clinical trials are a way for investigators to inquire whether a treatment is safe and if it's effective and if it provides better treatment than the standard of care options available that are approved by the governing bodies, like here in the U.S., the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. There are many websites available here in the U.S. would be the clinicaltrials.gov, as well as the National Cancer Institute Clinical Trials. I know that Longevity also has a clinical trial finder available on their website. There's a lot of resources to see if there's trials that are available and appropriate for you, but the best source for that is to typically talk to your multidisciplinary team and your oncologist providing care for you so that you can make an informed decision about what's next best treatment for you. Finally, I will conclude with that it is important to have support while you're going through your treatment or your loved one is going through your treatment. There are many options available for support, including social work, nutrition, or dietary services, as well as palliative care. So palliative care is a supportive oncology-based clinic or service that can help as an additional layer of support for patients with small cell lung cancer. Patients can help with managing their cancer-related symptoms as well as any advanced care planning to help with goals of care. What did you want for treatment? What are your goals for therapy? What should you expect? What do you anticipate matters most to you and to your loved ones? And so it's really important to have those discussions and have them early, as well as to have your cancer-related symptoms managed, because when they're managed, you can stay on treatment longer, stay out of the hospital more, and stay on therapy, which is what you definitely need if that is recommended by your physicians and your team. So with that, I will conclude, and I'm happy to take any questions or comments about small cell lung cancer and the topics we discussed today. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Shields. That was really excellent, just outstanding, a stellar presentation, and you really set the stage for today's program. So, and I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Kenneth Rosenzweig, and Dr. Rosenzweig is professor and chair, Department of Radiation Oncology, ICANN School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, system chair, Mount Sinai Health System. And Dr. Rosenzweig will be addressing the role of radiation treatments, including types of radiation treatment, clinical trials, how research contributes to treatment options, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Rosenzweig.
Thank you, Dr. Besner, and thank you so much for having me today. So I'm going to talk about the role of radiation in the treatment of small cell lung cancer. So like we've talked about a bit already, small cell lung cancer we think about slightly differently than non-small cell lung cancer, which is more common. So with small cell lung cancer, we divide patients when they first show up into whether they have disease just limited to the chest or has it spread outside of the lungs. And just like chemotherapy can be a little bit different in those two situations, the radiation can also be different in those situations. So when small cell lung cancer is what we call limited or just only in the lungs, radiation is a key part of the curative treatment of small cell lung cancer. So we do the radiation at the same time as the chemotherapy in an effort to kill all the disease in the lung. So a patient will come in for chemo and then right afterwards go to the radiation clinic to get the treatment or vice versa. That really doesn't matter much. So sometimes that can cause increase in side effects because you're getting two treatments at the same time. Particularly tiredness and irritation of the esophagus. And the esophagus is the tube that goes from the mouth to the stomach, so that can get a little sore from the radiation, and people might need some help in terms of medication or just changing their diet to help them get food down. Oh, but that's something that can typically be taken care of fairly easily. The radiation is done two different ways, and it depends a little bit on the style of the physician. Sometimes the radiation is done twice a day over the course of 3 weeks, or more typically it's done as a daily treatment over the course of 6 to 7 weeks, and in which case it overlaps two cycles of the chemotherapy. And again, this is done for situations where we're trying to cure the small cell lung cancer. At the end of treatment, depending on the situation, the radiation oncologist might offer radiation to the brain. Now, this doesn't mean that someone has tumors in the brain, but we do know that small cell lung cancer does have a high likelihood of showing up in the brain, and sometimes we give brain radiation to take care of any microscopic disease that might be there before it ever shows up. And that's been shown to help people live longer, so it is something we typically recommend. But that would be a discussion to have with the radiation oncologist in terms of the potential side effects of treatment, because radiation of the brain can make people feel tired. The other situation with small cell lung cancer is when it has spread outside of the lung, or what we call extensive disease. Now, as discussed, that is mostly the role of chemotherapy, because you want a treatment that can travel all over the body to kill the cancer wherever it might be. But radiation does have a role in extensive stage lung cancer. So typically we can give radiation to any disease that is in the lung to make it less likely to come back, or we can give radiation to any spots elsewhere in the body that might be causing symptoms, such as a disease in the bone or another part of the body. Also, at the end of treatment, again, we can consider giving radiation to the brain, even if there isn't any disease there, with the same rationale that there might be some cells that can develop into brain tumors later on, and the radiation might help in that situation. But most of the time these days, we just keep a close eye on the brain to make sure that nothing shows up. So there are some types of radiation treatments that you might have heard about in the news or from friends who have received it, where we do very, very focused radiation, or what we call stereotactic radiation. That's more commonly used in non-small cell lung cancer. So if your radiation oncologist isn't talking about stereotactic treatment for your particular situation, they're not making a mistake, but it's just something that we only use sparingly in small cell lung cancer, because usually it's not going to be a help in small cell. It's mostly used in non-small cell. Of course, like most things, there are some exceptions that might pop up. But again, the general sense is that the more traditional treatments are most effective in small cell, and some of these newer treatments really haven't found a role in small cell as of yet. In addition, there's a treatment called proton radiation, which is done in a separate facility with a proton machine, and it's a very, very precise type of radiation. Again, that's really used only for very specific situations and not as commonly in small cell lung cancer. So if your physician isn't recommending that, again, it's not because he's not aware of the technology, but it's mostly because it might not be particularly useful for your situation. I also wanted to talk today a little bit about clinical trials. So a lot of the advances that I've talked about today that have established how we treat patients are because of clinical trials that were done a few years ago, or even as long as 20 years ago. So for example, 20 years ago, we typically did the chemotherapy and the radiation separately in small cell lung cancer. But then there was a clinical trial where they did both treatments at the same time and found people lived longer in that situation, and that became the standard of care. So that's typically how clinical trials advance the field, by taking these little small steps where you change one component of treatment and see if it helps people live longer than what was previously done. And then the same type of rationale is with new medications. So, for example, as discussed, immunotherapy is now used more in small cell lung cancer that has spread outside of the lung. Again, that was the result of a clinical trial that added immunotherapy to the usual treatments and showed that people live longer. So if clinical trials are available where you're getting your treatment, it's certainly something worthwhile to discuss with your doctor, and she can discuss how this might be effective for you and how that might benefit you. But of course, if you don't want to be in a clinical trial, then the standard of care would be offered to you. But the kind of the old-timey feeling that, you know, someone's coming down with a flask with steam coming out and pouring it into your IV bag, that's just not how trials are done. It's usually these small changes and small improvements that we're looking for over a long period of time. And I think the final thing I want to discuss today is, you know, it's very important that people who are going through treatment for small cell lung cancer, and really for any cancer, maintain a high quality of life. And if you're having any difficulties with your quality of life, it's something to refer to speak to your medical team about and how we might be able to improve that. So, of course, there's a whole gamut of problems that can affect your quality of life. So fatigue is a very common problem in people who have cancer for a variety of reasons. Tumors by themselves can cause people to feel tired. The treatments that we give to people can make people feel tired. The inconvenience of getting treatment is also something that's tiring. So they all can add up and conspire against people. There aren't great treatments for fatigue other than treating the underlying cancer and getting over with treatment, but that's something that people need to prepare themselves for. Of course, pain is another significant problem that can lower someone's quality of life, and that is something where there are a lot of treatments for. So sometimes we can give, you know, radiation to a painful lesion if that's causing a problem, or pain medications can help alleviate some of the pain from treatment or pain from the tumor. So it's very important not to be stoic when you're speaking to your physician and to let them know what you're going through, because there might be some excellent treatments and ways that we can help improve your quality of life. And certainly treatment and dealing with cancer is tough enough without having other problems. And if there's anything that we can make things better, we certainly want to address that as well. So once again, I want to thank you for having me today, and I'll send it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Rosenzweig. That was an excellent presentation, a really very informative about the role of radiation treatments and also their helping to manage cancer pain and also the importance of communication with healthcare teams. So thank you. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Elizabeth O'Donnell, and Dr. O'Donnell is Clinical Director of Early Detection and Prevention of Cancer, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. O'Donnell will be addressing the role of activity and movement, quality of life, guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. O'Donnell.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for the invitation to be a part of this discussion. Today, I'm going to be talking about the role of activity and movement, quality of life, and guidelines for preparing for your visits, whether they be telemedicine or in person. I'm going to begin with talking about activity and movement. One of the challenges of having a cancer diagnosis or going through cancer treatment can be the way that it makes you feel. And many times patients feel tired, and maybe even a little wiped out from some of the symptoms of either the disease or their cancer treatments. And I've been asked to talk to you a little bit today about the role of activity and continuing to move. Lifestyle medicine is the study of exercise, nutrition, sleep, stress, into your medical care. And one of the things we know is that staying active is very important. And that doesn't mean that you need to train for the Boston Marathon. What we encourage you to do, though, is to try to stay active and to limit the amount of sedentary time. These days, you know, there's so much of an opportunity to be on your phone and to not have to move around a bunch. And so one of the goals of this discussion is to think about ways as before and during and after your cancer treatment that you can stay active. So beginning just with trying to limit the amount of seated time or laying in bed time, moving to a chair and getting up and moving around your home. There's often a tendency for people to try to take over doing some of your chores and activities. It's actually good to try and keep doing those small little activities like emptying the dishwasher, things like that, are actually in some ways a form of exercise. So it's a little bit use it or lose it. And so I encourage you to continue to do the things that you've normally done. In addition to that, exercise can play a role. First and foremost, always talk to your doctor about the safety of exercise, particularly if you have any symptoms like chest pain or shortness of breath. In general, though, exercise and activity is associated with improved mood, quality of life, and sleep improvement as well. And so exercise can take a lot of forms. As I mentioned, it doesn't need to be running a marathon. It can be something as joyful as just putting on some music and dancing in your kitchen. Yoga is another activity that can be done, you know, from very mild to very strenuous. Stationary bikes and things like that can give you more traditional cardiovascular exercise. Being active, going for walks now that the good weather is approaching, can also really be good for the spirits and also for cardiovascular health. It's important, too, sometimes trying to engage others in activity. So if you have a friend, a partner, a spouse, trying to get them to participate with you can be motivational to you both, and you both get the benefit from those activity. But again, I think the goal as you go through therapy is understanding that it is safe and good for you to remain active and to try to make that a goal that will ultimately help you recover better from the treatment as you go through it. In addition to that, another important aspect of your care is getting the most out of your medical visits. Since COVID, we've had the opportunity to do telemedicine or telehealth visits. And what's nice about those is, you know, it creates the opportunity, or I guess it limits the necessity of always going to the cancer center and having to make that outing. It also can often allow for the incorporation of other members of your family onto the Zoom or the call. And so when you think about how to prepare for any of your medical visits, I'm a big fan of making a list. Sometimes you're seeing your physician weekly, but sometimes it's every couple of weeks. And, you know, jotting things down as you go along or making note of them in your phone, especially in this day and age, can be highly beneficial, especially if you have a treatment and there's a couple weeks in between the next one, how you feel immediately after, if there are side effects, taking note of those that you might not remember 3 weeks later. But if you bring them up at the time of your visit, it enables your physician to make some alterations, potentially add some supportive medicine so that the next time around you may not experience those symptoms. I think the important thing to know when you think about these medical visits is that your physician and your entire care team really want to help you, and they want to know what's going on. And so really being open and sharing the good and the bad can help your care team optimize your experience with your cancer care. And, you know, we don't want to think that our patients are trying not to complain or do things like that. We want to know what's going on because, you know, there are so many tools that we have that we can help to make your experience better. So I really encourage, both the patients and their caregivers to keep some notes and to feel free to bring them up and voice them in the visits. I also do suggest that even if you're doing a telemedicine visit, if you can have a second set of ears there, you know, another person who can listen and maybe take notes or share notes that you've already made, just so that, you know, there sometimes in that moment it's hard to remember everything that was said. So it's always nice to have a second person there, and I think that telemedicine can help make that opportunity easier. And, you know, in general, see these visits as your opportunity to get the information you need, to share the information you need, and to really optimize your care. So that has been my presentation. Again, thank you for the invitation. I pass it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. O'Donnell. That was an outstanding presentation. Just wonderful information for people in terms of the importance of just activity and movement, and also the communication with the healthcare team is so important. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Diana Bearden. And Ms. Diana Bearden is a oncology dietitian with the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center. And Ms. Bearden will be addressing nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. Nutrition and hydration are essential in your tolerance to treatment and providing you the energy to do the things that you enjoy. Now, your diet might be modified either prior, during, or even after your cancer treatment to assist with managing any potential side effects you may experience. Some side effects that are possible include things like dry mouth, difficulty swallowing, maybe some changes in taste, a decrease in appetite, and maybe an increase in fatigue. During your course of treatment, your nutritional needs can increase. This may require a change in the foods that you eat or even the meal pattern that you're accustomed to. If you're not able to meet your nutrition needs, it can impact your overall health and potentially your treatment plan, such as your treatment may be delayed, you may not tolerate your treatment as well. So it's just really important to be in communication with your healthcare team during all stages of your treatment. A dietitian is a member of the healthcare team and is there to help support you. A dietitian can provide you with specific information unique to you, such as your calorie needs, protein needs, and fluid needs. The dietitian can also sit with you and assist with modification of your diet to ensure that you get in what you need and give you the tools in order to do that. Oftentimes with lung cancer, a patient becomes fatigued with eating. It's very common, oftentimes feeling full quickly. And this can result in eating less than normal. You may feel full, you may feel satisfied, and not really have the awareness of the change in the volume that you're consuming. But monitoring things like your weight, getting diet recalls from you, and getting feedback from how you're tolerating your treatment, any side effects that you're having, the dietitian can work to come up with a plan that will help you get where you need to be. Oftentimes when we lose weight in the presence and during time of cancer therapy, cancer treatment, we end up losing more muscle than we do fat. And the concern with that is muscle is what gives us the endurance to do the things that we enjoy. It gives us the strength to do the things that we enjoy, even down to swallowing and getting up out of a chair. It's very important that we may retain that muscle mass, that we hold on to what we can. And so weight management is something that's going to be part of your conversation with your healthcare team. If there's a shift in your weight, they're going to bring that to your attention and talk with you about that and work with you on halting any unintentional weight loss. Now, there are medications to help with assisting side effects, such as pain and anything other side effect that you might be going through. Make sure that you talk with your healthcare team, that you and maybe another loved one understand how to take the medications. When you're not feeling well, it's always good to have that backup to help support you. But if you're experiencing side effects when you're eating, take note of that. Bring that to the healthcare team. It helps us help you, and that's what we're here for. Dehydration is something we oftentimes overlook, and when there's a decrease in intake, there's usually a decrease in fluid intake as well. Dehydration can bring its own set of side effects, such as an increase in the feeling of nausea. It can actually amplify the feeling of fatigue. It can make you feel dizzy and lightheaded. Fluid is anything that's liquid at room temperature, such as water, milk, sports drinks, juice. A general guideline is most people need between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid a day. Some treatments may increase your need for fluid intake, so talk with your healthcare team to understand your unique needs. In closing, there are several members of the healthcare team dedicated to you and helping you through this journey. Please know them and reach out to them, and the sooner, the better. Thank you for allowing me to be part of today's workshop. I'll now pass the line back over to Carolyn.
Thank you so much, Ms. Jordan. That was excellent. Just wonderful information for our participants and really very good tips. So I appreciate your being on this call. Thank you. And our next speaker is from the Longevity Foundation, Christine Cox Santiago. And Ms. Santiago is Senior Director of Care Partner Initiatives, Longevity Foundation. And she'll be addressing Longevity Foundation's free programs and services. And we'll provide you with information about how to connect with them in terms of their helpline, their website, and information as well. So I'm going to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Santiago.
Thank you to Cancer Care and to Dr. Messner for the opportunity to share some of the services and programs that the Longevity Foundation offers. I want to just point out that patient advocacy organizations like Longevity are really great resources and partners for people as they go through their cancer journey. And we can kind of provide support and complement what our medical providers offer. So please reach out. We're here to help you. Everything that we offer is free, no charge, and we're here for you. So Longevity is a nonprofit patient advocacy foundation, which is dedicated to providing support for people with lung cancer, with a lung cancer diagnosis, and their care partners. The services, we offer a ton of educational information on our website, which there's a ton of information there. But today I want to talk through some of the services that I think are really helpful for people with a small cell lung cancer diagnosis. And a lot of those resources come out of our patient services team, which is run by our survivorship and support team. And that includes people who are certified navigators and oncology nurses, as well as people who have been caregivers. And these are people who really know how to help because we've been there. And our team can help connect you to the resources that are on the website, which can provide additional detailed information. So as Dr. Messner mentioned, we have a helpline, which is staffed by oncology social workers through Cancer Care. I'm going to put the number out there, but I'm sure it will be shared with you, and you probably have it already, hopefully. But the number is 844-360-5864. And this helpline is there to provide practical assistance, financial assistance, and counseling assistance, and can really hold out a virtual hand to help you navigate, you and your care partner, navigate the journey that you're going through. Again, it's free of charge. Some of the services that I personally find most valuable for people are Longevity's peer support programs. Generally speaking, if you email info@longevity, LUNGEVITY.org, that email address can get you to the right people in our foundation to provide information. But our peer support grant programs, and I would say especially for small cell lung cancer, which is a less common than other types of lung cancer, is really wonderful. One of my most favorite programs is our Lifeline Support Partners program. And what we do is we connect people diagnosed with lung cancer or caregivers with people who are going through similar situations. So maybe they have the same type of lung cancer, or they live in the same city, or they're the same age, or they have similar interests. And we connect them, we kind of buddy them up so they can share their experiences. And the friendships and bonds that have grown through this program through an initial introduction made by Longevity are really beautiful to watch flourish. And these the pairing is, I would say, invaluable to hear from peers what others are experiencing, what questions should I ask my doctor, et cetera. So I would highly recommend reaching out to info@longevity.org or going to our website and signing up to be a Lifeline support partner. We also have clinical trial ambassadors, and those are individuals who have participated in a clinical trial or have been a care partner to someone who's participated in a clinical trial and can really talk about the benefits as to why that is something that that people should consider as they go through their journey. One second, I apologize. Dr. Shields did mention that we also have a clinical trials finder on our website to help dial down for what specific type of lung cancer or small cell lung cancer you have to connect with or see what options are available for exploring clinical trials, which might be an appropriate treatment plan for you. We also have online communities. This was incredibly valuable during the height of COVID. It existed prior to COVID and continues to exist. But we have many Facebook groups where people have, and they're private Facebook groups where people, again, build these relationships and learn from each other and feel like they're not alone through this journey. We have meetups, virtual meetups based on the type of lung cancer as well as ones for caregivers. And those are on Zoom, and I think they're typically in the evenings because it's mostly so we can catch people on the West Coast. Again, we used to do these in person more, but the Zoom option allows us to reach more people and do them more frequently, but a really nice resource so people know that they're not alone. And then we have patient gateways on our website, which is a little more kind of in-depth than the Facebook group and ties to resources that we have. The small cell lung cancer gateway is sclc.longevity.org. And on there, you can learn more about small cell lung cancer. It helps you find a specialist, learn about clinical trials, et cetera. But it really is a nice, like, one central place to find information and connect. We also have host conferences. So earlier in May, we had our HOPE Summit. I think we had around 300 people there. I think maybe a little bit over. I forget the number. But it's a really wonderful 2.5-day conference, might be 2 days, but over 3 days, where people come together to hang out with each other and meet with experts in the lung cancer field. So we have small cell lung cancer experts who speak, and it's an opportunity to ask questions. They won't provide medical advice, but to ask questions and hear what others are curious about and learn from each other and really build those bonds that maybe you formed online or over the phone with your Lifeline support partner. But it's really a really cool, uplifting event. And then in the fall, we'll have our International Lung Cancer Survivorship Conference, which is virtual because of the international nature. And that's another great opportunity that I suggest that you check out. And all this information is on longevity.org. And then lastly, I will just say that Longevity does a lot of policy work to really across the spectrum of prevention, screening, diagnosis, care, quality of care, cost of care, et cetera. And it's really helpful to have individual stories and experiences that people are going through in our policy work. So we have a Longevity Action Network, which I would recommend that you sign up to learn more about policy that's impacting people with small cell lung cancer and how you can use your stories and voices to influence policy. And that is action.longevity.org. So I'll just leave with a few numbers. The helpline staffed by Cancer Care is 844-360-5864. The main email for Longevity is info@longevity.org. If you email us there, we'll get you to the right people within Longevity who can get you whatever information you're looking for. And my email is ksantiago@longevity.org. So thank you thank you to the previous speakers. You all were fantastic and shared really helpful information. And I will turn it back to Dr. Messner.
wonderful and lots of information for participants. And we will be sending a SurveyMonkey after today's program, which is evaluation of the program. But in that evaluation, we'll include all of the phone numbers, email addresses, info information, any information that was given out during the program about longevity or cancer care or any of the other resources that were given out during the program itself. So thank you. And I'm just going to say a few words about cancer care. I'm Carolyn Messner. I'm Senior Director of Education Training at Cancer Care. And so I'd like to talk about Cancer Care's free programs and services. Now, many people call us from the United States with our hope on our HOPE line, which is 800-813-4673, and they speak with an oncology social worker. And usually they come with some particular question or concern that the social worker addresses, and then they go over all the services that we offer. So what are those services? So we do offer practical, financial, and co-payment assistance. We also have online support groups, and there are online support groups on specific types of cancer, like small cell lung cancer, as well as every type of cancer. And then we also have online support groups for caregivers, for older adults, younger adults. So just the whole gamut of people, and you can look on our website, www.cancercare.org, for a listing of all of the different online support groups that we offer. And we also offer support, so a chance to talk with one of our oncology social workers. And we also have these workshops, about 80 per year, and we also have a number of publications that you can access. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Emma to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we'll take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So we have a question, and this would be for Dr. Shields. I did not realize there was a difference between non-small cell lung cancer and small cell lung cancer. My husband was just diagnosed with non-small cell lung cancer.
Yes, absolutely. So non-small cell lung cancer and small cell lung cancer are different types of lung cancer. There are other more rare forms of lung cancer that don't fall into these two major categories, but that's really not the distinction we're talking about today. So small cell lung cancer was named this diagnosis because it is, by appearance, under the microscope, small. It's much smaller than its counterpart, non-small cell lung cancer. Non-small cell lung cancer makes up the majority of lung cancer. We talked about earlier, 14 to 15% is small cell, and the remaining basket of lung cancer kind of falls into that non-small cell, so we're more talking in the 80% range. So non-small cell lung cancer is treated very differently. Some of the same kind of tools in the toolkit, including chemotherapy, immunotherapy, but there is a role for targeted therapy, as there is more information about the mutations that may drive non-small cell, and so it's really important to, you know, speak to your multidisciplinary team and your medical oncologist about what treatment options are available and what other genetic testing on the cancer may be available to help tailor and personalize your treatment plan.
Excellent. Thank you. And another question for you, Dr. Shields. How do I know if I'm eligible for clinical trials of new therapies? Does my small cell lung cancer have to be a certain stage or aggression?
So absolutely. So there are criteria to designate eligibility for clinical trials. I will say I looked earlier this week for the USA for active recruiting trials in the U.S. As of this week, there are 119 active clinical trials for small cell lung cancer. So this includes different treatment modalities, including chemo or radiation or different ways that we can potentially improve the standard of care therapy we're already giving. And so some of those are for limited stage, some of them are for extensive stage, some of them are for extensive stage, maybe after you've had a line or two of treatment, and if the cancer has come back or failed to respond to treatment. And so it's really important if you speak with your medical oncologist or your radiation oncologist, depending on what trial and what ideas you're thinking about for treatment within that multidisciplinary team, you know, you can see whether you're eligible because there are a list of criteria that are required as well as criteria that may exclude you from trials and make you not eligible. So if you talk to your doctor more, they can give you that medical advice as to helping you guide which trials may be the right direction for you.
Excellent. And another question for you, Dr. Shields. What are some new therapies on the horizon for small cell lung cancer that you find most promising?
Absolutely. So, you know, I think that there are quite a few of that, you know, 119 active recruiting trials in the U.S., and there's many more in the international space. I think there's a lot of really exciting trials that are coming over the horizon for small cell. Typically, there are some that are in the first line, you know, but as well as there are some that are in the second line or third line that are very exciting. And so these kind of have to go head-to-head to the standard of care and demonstrate and prove that they're either, you know, equal or superior, depending on the type of trial. And so there's a lot of really neat trials out there looking at the DNA damage and how the cell can repair, cancer cell can repair, and how do we block that? You know, looking at the pathways that are on the outside of small cell and how do we maybe use an antibody to bind that and bring a payload of chemotherapy there and enter into the cell like a Trojan horse. So there's quite a few therapies that are out there or using additional therapies on top of immunotherapy to see if we can make it work even more effectively. So a lot of really exciting things that are out there for small cell.
And another question for you, Dr. Shields. I'm a 55-year-old woman with small cell lung cancer. I've never smoked a day in my life, been around asbestos, radiation, or had long-term exposure to harmful chemicals that could cause this. That being said, are there genetic factors for small cell lung cancer?
So yes, there are rare genetic, what we call germline, or the DNA that you inherit from your mom and dad when you're born. There are rare predisposing factors, but that is of the minority. If you have never smoked, our national guidelines recommend genetic testing to check for that particular mutation, an RB1 mutation, as well as looking at other factors that may be potential treatments like targeted therapy. There are some trials, like I mentioned, the NCI has some trials with Dr. Anish Thomas, as well as, you know, making sure the diagnosis is correct, having a thoracic pathologist, someone who is focused in lung cancer with that expertise, looking and re-reviewing, getting a second opinion may be warranted. So I think there's additional, you know, testing that could be considered, and I would recommend you speak with your doctor about what's right for you.
Excellent. And I just want to remind everybody that we have a part two of this program, What's New in Diagnostic Technologies for People Living with Small Cell Lung Cancer, and that will take place on June 13th. Some of you have signed up for this already, but if you haven't, we'll be sending reminders about that. I'm going to ask our speakers, Dr. Shields and Ms. Santiago, just to provide a takeaway for the audience from today's program. So I'll start with you, Dr. Shields. Things you'd like people to take away from today's program.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an honor to speak with the 213-plus participants on this call and to be reaching around the world to help improve access and information for patients with small cell lung cancer. You know, I think that the biggest takeaway is that, you know, your doctors, your care team are here for you. There are treatments that we can offer to help get you through your journey with small cell lung cancer. It's important to have early integration of palliative care if possible and if available. It's important to have shared decision-making with your multidisciplinary team. It's also really important to know what clinical trials may be available for you if you're eligible, if it's appropriate. And it's also, you know, vital for us in the time of COVID and flu and all these other things like seasonal allergies to know what to look for, what precautions to have, when to call your doctor or when to seek care, and what to expect from side effects from treatments and who to call and when to call and what to do. So hopefully, I think, you know, this has been a wonderful workshop from my experience. I hope that you all had some opportunities to take away some information that was helpful to you and to your loved ones.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Shields. A pleasure to have you on the call today, really. And Ms. Santiago, do you want to add in terms of the takeaway?
Yeah, I would echo everything Dr. Shields said. Please also use patient advocacy organizations as your ally. Use our resources. Call us, email us. We're here to help you and help navigate the process. And also, I would say just maybe be aggressive and ask for the resources that Dr. Shields mentioned. Not every location is going to openly offer palliative care, but it's an amazing resource which is underutilized and offers benefits beyond what is on paper, I would say. And also be prepared when you go to the doctor. Look at our website. Look at other websites for questions to ask so that when you have that precious time face-to-face or virtually, that you get the most out of your appointments. But, and, you know, love each other and be kind to everyone. But thank you for the opportunity to share our resources.
Thank you. Thanks so much. And so as we conclude the program today, I would not want anyone to leave this program thinking that you're alone. We want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support, which includes Longevity Foundation, Cancer Care, your healthcare team, you know, your oncologist, your radiation oncologist, your oncology nurse, oncology social worker, patient navigator, financial navigator, lots of people in your own setting that can help you. And you also can contact the organizations, both Longevity Foundation as a go-to organization, as well as Cancer Care. And, you know, I think that we really appreciate the questions that you all asked. We want you, for those of you who asked a question today, we want you to take that question back to your healthcare team. And for those of you who are in queue to ask a question but didn't get to ask your question, please take your question back to your healthcare team. Why is that? Because they know you the best, and they can help address your questions. With the information you've learned today, you now can ask your question perhaps with a little bit more confidence, a little bit more knowledge, and you may frame your question slightly differently, and you'll keep asking the question until you get the answers that you need. And so you can ask a question over and over again. It's okay to do that. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.